The next matter on the calendar is the State of Minnesota versus David Edward Williams Jr. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments, even though we probably know who you are, but this matter is being recorded and will be online, so our audience may not know who you are.
Thank you, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, David Williams, Jr. This court must reverse Mr. Williams' conviction and allow him to withdraw his constitutionally inaccurate guilty plea. This court reviews this matter de novo. Mr. Williams' plea was inaccurate because he testified that he did not remember striking his mother in the head with a hammer, an act that would have constituted a substantial step towards completing the intended crime of first-degree premeditated intentional murder.
Well, weren't there other substantial steps, though? I mean, that's the one, as far as the record, is there anything in the record, just before you get to that question, though, Sure. Is there anything in this record that indicates he didn't remember any of the other actions that he had during this episode?
The other things he said he didn't remember, Your Honor, he repeatedly said he didn't remember the hammer. He also said he didn't remember taping his mother to a chair at any point. That's the one thing that, as I recall, he said he specifically didn't remember.
Okay.
And you're right, there were other acts, of course, that he said he did remember, coming over to the house, bringing the bag with all the equipment, including the shotgun, and saying he needed to hurt his mother. The difference, though, is that none of those acts were a substantial step towards completing a first-degree premeditated intentional murder. And if you look at the abandonment case law, you'll see why. I'm sorry, Your Honor, you had a question.
But isn't bringing a bag of weapons to a house that, to his parents' house, where his parents had changed the locks, so he didn't have permission to be in that house, bringing those weapons in that house, doesn't that go beyond mere planning?
It doesn't, Your Honor. And if you think about what could have happened, let's say Mr. Williams comes in the house with his bag and he fully intends to commit the crime. And then he sees his mother and he says, you know what, I can't do it. And he turns around and he leaves. Has he committed the crime of attempted first-degree premeditated intentional murder?
But what if he pointed the gun and then decided not to shoot her? I mean, how is that any different? Because in your example, it's him deciding not to do it that makes it not a substantial step.
I think, Your Honor, the key is the facts as they happen. What happened here is Mr. Williams came in the house with the bag. His mother let him in. His mother was pleased to see him. They were going to watch a movie. She sat down to watch the movie, and then he stood behind her. This is what he admitted at the plea hearing, which is the only record that matters for the sanctity of the guilty plea, is the plea hearing. And he stood behind her and said he was going to hurt her, and then he hit her with the hammer, which he said he didn't remember. If at any point before he hits her with the hammer, he turns around and leaves, under those facts, he has abandoned any attempt. He has not taken a substantial step towards committing the crime. If you look at every attempted murder case, and there are several cited in our brief, they all involve something like a swing and miss, or a shoot and miss, or a swing and hit, but death doesn't result, but that's clearly the intent. None of them involve gathering the information or gathering the tools to complete the crime, going to the scene of the crime, and then not doing something. The attempt, the substantial step comes, the point of no return comes, once you actually act on your intent to commit the murder. And in this case, that didn't happen until he allegedly used the hammer. And that's why his lack of memory as to the hammer is so important. And it's important to keep in mind.
But there are other steps, too. You were talking earlier about the things that he did remember. And so some of the things he did remember, he remembers getting the bag. He remembers being upset because he was locked out. He remembers going to the house and standing behind her. You mentioned he didn't remember taping her to the chair.
Correct.
But what did he remember after that?
There wasn't much talk about after that. He also didn't remember throwing pills at his parents. That was another thing he specifically said he didn't remember. I believe he said at the plea hearing he remembered pointing the shotgun at his father.
Yep.
But that is a separate dismissed count. So if Mr. Williams had been pleading guilty to second-degree assault of his father, which had originally been charged as count two, then fine. A factual basis for that plea would be completely
adequate.
Okay, but
let's step back from that a little bit, because didn't he remember loading the shotgun? And
I believe so. I can't recall exactly. I mean, the plea transcript would say what he did and didn't remember.
And didn't he remember pointing his mother in the direction of the door so that when his father came in, the first thing that his father would see was his mother tied up? So it seems a little inconsistent for him to say he doesn't remember. Well, I guess you could say, okay, fine. He claims he doesn't remember taping her up, but he certainly remembers seeing her taped up in a chair and pointing her in the direction of the door so father could see her when he came in and had a loaded shotgun at that time as well.
Absolutely.
How is that not a substantial step right there?
Well, a substantial step towards what, Your Honor? I mean, that might be a substantial step towards assaulting his father, but it has nothing to do with attempting to murder his mother. And I think you've hit on something really important. You said it seems inconsistent for him to say he doesn't remember X, but he does remember Y. And that may be true. And if this was a jury trial, and we had a verdict after a jury trial, there's no way we could stand here and say the evidence is insufficient to support the verdict, because the jury can evaluate credibility. The jury can make a decision.
I understand that, but that's a separate issue. But here, focusing on the facts here, how is that not? Because you said all the other cases, there's a substantial step. There's something that's being done beforehand. Well, if he doesn't recall taping his mother to the chair, but he does recall have seen his mother taped to a chair and then pointing her in the direction and then making sure that there's a loaded gun, how is that not a substantial step toward possible attempted murder? It could be of father, it could be of mother, it could be of him, because he did say that he wanted to kill somebody, either his parents or himself or everybody.
Now, I think, Your Honor, you're expanding the charge with that line of questioning. The charge is attempted murder of his mother. Very specifically, not attempted murder of his father.
I understand that, but how is she not part of that when she's taped to a chair and he's pointing the hurt toward the father with a loaded shotgun in hand?
He hasn't pointed the shotgun at her. He hasn't attempted to kill her with the shotgun. He hasn't squeezed the trigger of the shotgun. Everything in that fact scenario is directed at the father. And there's no claim.
How can you say that when
that
she's tied up in a chair?
I'm sorry, what?
How can you say that when she's tied up in a chair? That I'm struggling with that.
First of all, he said he didn't remember tying her to the chair. But we have to take him, you know, the factual. He has to admit the crime. That's the point of the factual basis.
Counsel,
number two
are you?
Is, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry,
please.
Finish your response.
Number two is all of those actions, none of those actions are a substantial step towards murdering his mother. The only act that would be a substantial step towards murdering his mother is taking some act to physically harm his mother. The only act at issue here that could have satisfied that element is the hammer. He doesn't attempt to kill his mother with the shotgun. That's never been the state's theory in this case. The shotgun goes towards the father. He wasn't pleading guilty to anything about the father. If he withdraws his plea and we have a trial and the charge against the father comes back, all of that is fair game. Yes, Your Honor, please.
Are you familiar with an older case, State v. Dumas? It's 118 Minnesota 777, decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1912. In that case, the court said in considering what is a attempted crime, it says, and a substantial step, the court said each case must depend largely upon its particular facts and inferences, which the jury may reasonably draw thereon. It may be stated, however, as a general proposition, to constitute an attempt to commit a crime, there must be an intent to commit it, followed by an overt act or acts tending but failing to accomplish it. The overt act need not be such that, if not interrupted, they must result in commission of the crime. So you just stated, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong in paraphrasing what you said, but there has to be some, restate what you said about.
I think what I said is something like he has to take some act towards his mother, because she's the intended victim here, that is the substantial step towards the crime, and it has to be an act taken towards the intended victim.
But I thought you said something about the weapon or
yeah, I think in this particular case, there's no substantial step until he uses a weapon towards accomplishing what is the intended goal, which is killing his mother. And I think the Dumas case, what you just quoted, supports that, because what the part you just read includes the phrase, he has to do something tending but failing to accomplish,
but
and I don't remember the rest of the quote, but the intended goal.
But it also says the acts need not be such that, if not interrupted, they must have resulted in commission of the crime. So that suggests to me that it doesn't have to be so far as you're actually pointing the gun at someone. And there's another sentence after what I just read that I didn't read that I should read, which says, they must, however, be something more than mere preparation remote from time and place of the intended crime. The preparation remote from time and place of the intended crime. So I'm struggling with why this isn't more than mere preparation. And the intent statute talks about more than mere preparation.
I agree.
And also the State v. Meepkin case cited by the respondent, that was a case involving an alleged
it's a sex assault.
Criminal sexual conduct, yeah, second degree attempted criminal sexual conduct. But the defendant put his hand on the girl's thigh, but it wasn't anything more than that. And so it sounds to me like you're demanding a higher standard than what the standard in the State v. Meepkin case.
I don't think so at all, Your Honor. I think Meepkin went way further than Mr. Williams did, if you're not counting the hammer. In addition to putting his hand on the girl's thigh, which is about 1 inch from the area at issue, the girl's genitals or crotch, which is at issue in a second-degree crim sex case, he was sexually propositioning her at the time he did it. So there's no way to argue that that is mere preparation. That is coming 1 inch away from actually completing the crime. If Mr. Williams had said during his plea hearing, I picked up the hammer, I held it back like this, I started to swing it, and then I don't remember what happened, that would be a lot closer to Meepkin.
But he only had weapons at the house because he intended to kill his mother. I mean, it's clear he intended to kill his mother.
I agree. He admitted that, and that's true. But again, come back to the hypothetical. If he walks in the house and puts the bag down and says, I can't do it, and turns around and leaves, has he really...
Isn't abandonment a different question than whether he's taken a substantial step?
No, it's not. Because you can't abandon. Once you've taken a substantial step, you've crossed the line, and you can't abandon. And what we want, this court has a couple of cases upholding that. They're Judge Johnson's opinions. If what we
what,
want
what
people to...
What cases are those?
I'm sorry, I don't have them in front of me, Your Honor, but I can get them to you. What we want people to do is abandon. We want to encourage people to abandon attempts. And that's why the law focuses so hard on where is the point of no return. And I agree that it's a squishy line. I mean, every case obviously has to be resolved on a case-by-case basis. The facts are, there's no hard and fast rule that says you must swing the hammer before it's an attempted murder. I agree with that as a general matter. In this case, however, given these facts, and by the way, that is clearly all the way along here what the state thought the substantial step was. was swinging the hammer. There's discussion in the factual basis about the, about what led up to that.
Can I stop you there? Because I'm just looking at the transcript, actually the portions that you cited in the brief. And one thing that was asked of him, first of all, he admits that he premeditated, that he said, they ask, you made the decision that either she dies or you're going to kill yourself, correct? And he says that it's correct. And specifically, you remember thinking you had to hurt your mom. Is that right? And he said, that's correct. And then the question was asked, you would agree that this was made in premeditation, a premeditated fashion? He said, that's correct. And then he was asked several times, you took a substantial step toward the commission of that crime, first-degree murder, with respect to your mom. Is that correct? And he says, that's correct. And then the judge elaborates, and I think this is the actual judge questioning him, and he said, so things like arriving with weapons, like making threats, and then ultimately striking your mother, assaulting her, using a weapon, those are things that are considered substantial steps toward the potential crime of murder, correct? That's correct. And you agree that you're guilty of that attempted murder. Yes, ma'am. So why isn't that sufficient? I mean, is substantial step, that's a fact-intensive question, isn't it?
I see I'm out of time. Do you mind if I answer the question?
Yeah, if you could answer my question.
Sure. Yes, it is a fact-intensive question. But him saying at the plea hearing, I took a substantial step, if as a matter of law he didn't, then it doesn't matter what he says. He can't admit to something, you know, the Iverson case is similar. In Iverson, the defendant repeatedly said at a plea hearing he had violated the predatory offender registration statute and said the things he did that supposedly violated the predatory offender registration statute. And the Minnesota Supreme Court on de novo review said, those things you did don't violate the predatory offender registration statute. The same thing is true here. If the thing he did, bringing the weapons to take the hammer out of it, because he says he doesn't remember that. So if the other things don't, in fact, constitute substantial steps, as the case law describes what a substantial step is, then it doesn't matter what he admitted, and this becomes a trial issue. And we can withdraw the plea, and we can have a trial, and the jury can decide. Thank you, Your Honors.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. This court should affirm the appellant's conviction for attempted first-degree murder because his guilty plea was accurate.
Well, can I ask you this? Was this a Norgaard plea?
I don't consider it a Norgaard plea per se.
But should it have been a Norgaard plea in light of the fact he says he didn't remember some of the acts he committed?
I don't think that was necessary in this case. As I interpret Norgaard and the cases that have come after Norgaard, Norgaard is used when the person either does not remember the offense in its entirety, which often happens, obviously, with intoxication-type situations, or if there is an element of the crime that the person simply doesn't remember committing. If a person doesn't remember certain facts, as opposed to an element, I think that's fundamentally different from Norgaard, and so the Norgaard procedure was not necessary.
Well, except does it really matter? I mean, in this case, I mean, maybe he didn't remember because he's mentally ill and he's got bipolar issues and
right. We don't know.
I mean, would we even be here today if this had been presented as a Norgaard plea?
I don't know the answer to that because there's intelligent public defenders like we have in this state are good at finding issues regardless. We wouldn't be here on this issue. I would probably agree with that, but we'd probably be here for some reason. But that said,
doesn't his absence of memory of using the hammer, isn't that an essential element that requires a Norgaard plea?
I would respectfully say it is not because it's one means of committing or taking a substantial step towards murder, one possible means or method or act that would constitute that, but it is not the element itself. And I think that with regard to this issue, there's really three.
How is it not an element? Isn't it an element of the attempt portion?
Well, the substantial step is the element, but that can be accomplished in any innumerable number of ways, I think. If that
But you just said it's an element. If it's an element, isn't that one of the reasons why you'd use a Norgaard plea?
Right. If the defendant didn't remember anything that would constitute a substantial step, then I would agree that a Norgaard plea would probably be necessary. But that isn't the case here.
All right. Since you didn't treat it as a Norgaard plea, right, then we do we have to analyze this without those facts, without the hitting and then the head with the hammer?
No, I mean, Your Honor, you don't. And
why not? I mean, if he doesn't remember that, mm-hmm, and there wasn't a Norgaard plea taken, so there's no, usually in order to supplement a Norgaard plea, you have the defendant admit that he understands what the result was and has reviewed the police records and that he doesn't deny that he did it.
Right.
And that he understands a jury could find that he did it. And you'd have those protections in here. We don't have that here, correct?
We don't have that specific line of questioning, but I think your question implicates the entire purpose of the accuracy requirement of guilty pleas, and that is not to ensure that there's technical compliance with court rules or procedures, but instead to ensure that a defendant doesn't plead guilty to a crime the state couldn't prove at trial. And as the courts have held and stated on numerous occasions, a reviewing court is to look at the record in determining that, which makes perfect sense. To determine what the state could prove at trial, you look at the record, see what's in the record, and see, can the state prove it at trial? That's different from a situation, I think, where a defendant, through their statements, negates an element of the offense, where they say, I did not do this, I did not commit a substantial step. Say in a DWI case, I wasn't drinking or using drugs, whatever the case might be. Where here there's no negation of anything. There's statements of not remembering things.
Well, let's set aside his use of the hammer. What evidence is there that he recalls of that constitutes a substantial step in your view?
Sure. Well, first of all, after purchasing a shotgun a few weeks before, he brought that shotgun along with other weapons, including a baseball bat, multiple knives, a hatchet, and duct tape, as well as ammunition for the shotgun, all in a bag to his parents' home. And I think one thing that's important to keep in mind as I go through this, by the way, is that there is no claim, as counsel indicated, that the defendant didn't intend this. He admitted he intended that to murder his mother, and that's not at issue here on appeal. So when you're looking at this fact, you look at it through that lens of someone who intended to do this. He went inside, conversed with his mother, stood behind her, told her he was going to hurt her, told her he was going to kill her or maybe her dad, his father, or himself. He did not remember duct taping her to the chair, but he remembered her being duct taped to the chair, and also admitted he was the only person with her in the residence, and he admitted to bringing the duct tape. It would seem safe to infer that she didn't duct tape herself to the chair.
Was there an admission that he was going to throw her as she sat in that chair, duct tape to the chair, down the stairs?
He said that he threatened to do that. I believe that was, I believe he did admit to that. He admitted to following her around the house during the assault. He said that he threatened her, as he threatened actually her, I believe, to throw her down the stairs, if I recall correctly. Yes. If she slapped her in the head, threatened to throw her down the stairs if she wouldn't be quiet, while he had a knife and hatchet in his hands. That's all at pages 31 through 32. He remembers sending a text message to his father, though he doesn't recall what prompted that text message. And then as there was discussion of during counsel's argument, when he set up the situation so that when his mother came home, or father came home, his the first thing you would see was him shooting, pointing the gun at him, and at him, with his mother in the chair, bleeding profusely. And again, this isn't just something that can be so easily confined as counsel would like the court to do, to say, well, that's the second-degree assault on the dad, you can't consider that. This is all part of the same behavioral incident, and it's all through the lens of somebody who admitted he intended to kill his mother, and for whom I think this court has to take that as a given fact. So when you look at it through that lens, those are absolutely substantial steps.
What about counsel's argument that he could have abandoned his intent to kill and we should consider that?
I have, I guess, two arguments with or two responses to that that are related. First of all, that isn't an issue that it was raised in any of the briefing in the case. that there was any sort of abandonment here. And secondly, 609.17 subdivision 3, which deals with abandonment, classifies abandonment as a defense. And that defense obviously was not raised in this case. And as I said before, hasn't been briefed. So I don't think it's something that the court can consider, and I don't think it's really something that's particularly well supported by the record. By the time he arguably abandoned any intent, I guess maybe when he allowed his parents to go to the hospital so his mom could receive treatment for her massive head injuries, he had taken numerous substantial steps by that point towards committing the crime, even though he did not actually end up killing his mother.
What's your best argument that we should actually consider the hammer incident?
Sure. First of all, as I said before, there was no indication by the defendant negating that statement. So it's not a situation like an Alford plea where his rationality is called into question or anything like that. There's numerous cases that are cited in the briefs. The Supreme Court's decisions in Hoagland, Iverson, Lucier, Raleigh, Rickert, and this court's decisions in Johnson, Sanchez, Williams, among others, that all stand for the proposition that a court looks to the record, and that's the language that's consistently used in the cases to determine the accuracy of a guilty plea. And that makes perfect sense in light of the primary purpose of the accuracy requirement. Again, not to ensure requirements with certain court rules or procedures, but instead to ensure that a defendant doesn't plead guilty and be convicted of something the state wouldn't be able to prove at trial. So it would make sense, if there's no claim by the defendant that this fact is not true, to look at the record in the case, and there's obviously a very replete record in this case with regard to the hammer and the use of the hammer that demonstrates that. I would note specifically the Lucier case where the court notes, indeed, the plea petition and colloquy may be supplemented by other evidence to establish the factual basis for a plea.
Was that done here, though?
Not formally, no. But it doesn't need to be, as my reading of the case is, because...
And it would have been if it had been designated a Norgard.
Correct. But the case
is... Isn't that the essence of why we're here?
Well, it's why counsel's able to make the argument he's making, but it's not a successful argument. And that's because, again, the courts consistently refer to, when reviewing the factual accuracy of a guilty plea, you look to the record. And that's in Norgard cases, that's in Alford cases, and it's just in regular guilty plea cases. I think if you look at the cases I just listed, you'll find, I think, all three of those types of cases within those. And so the courts don't say, we only look to the specific facts the defendant admits when examining the accuracy of a guilty plea, particularly when there's no claim by the defendant that a certain act did not happen, that the defendant did not do a certain thing, and they say, what the state's alleging there just isn't true. That presents a different situation, I think, and that's why the Alford procedure is in place to ensure that a defendant who wants to plead guilty despite maintaining innocence is, you know, fully apprised of it and has a very strong rational reason for doing so. Here we just have certain facts, and not even in our position, certainly not even arising to a complete element, but just certain facts that the defendant claims not to remember. That is my best argument for why the court can look beyond the transcript of the guilty plea. I'm not aware of any cases that limit the court to that. The cases all say the record is what the court reviews, and certainly courts know the difference between the record and the transcript of a guilty plea. They're two very different things, and one is only a small subset of the other, but the courts consistently use the language, the record. I'd submit that the appellant in this case, that their argument rests on three flawed premises, and I think that if the court agrees with me that any one of those three is flawed, that the court must affirm here. The first is what we've just been talking about, that the court cannot go beyond what the defendant explicitly said during his guilty plea. The second is that appellant's argument is premised on appellant not making the admission to the hammer strikes, which I also take some issue with. And secondly, that, again, as we discussed before, that it's premised on appellant not committing other acts, which were also a substantial step. If the court agrees with the state that any of those three things exist, then the court, I believe, must affirm and must find as much. I would note that there's been some question of what the defendant actually said as well. And I would note, first of all, and I think it was Judge Reyes who asked the question with regard to the shotgun, and loading the shotgun, that is specifically in the plea transcript. He did specifically admit to recalling loading the shotgun. I believe it was at pages 33 to 34, as I recall, of the transcript, just to clear that up. The last thing I wanted to briefly address is that I think the only reasonable inference to make from the appellant, what the appellant actually said, is that he did commit the assault with the hammer. That is, again, admitted that they were the only two people there, admitted that she clearly suffered these wounds with the hammer, and admitted to all those other acts we've been talking about, all those other assaultive and threatening acts. And from that, I would also submit that even though he didn't remember doing it, the only reasonable inference that a court can draw from that is that he did do it. And again, we're not looking at necessarily what exactly the defendant said, but what the state can prove at trial in terms of making sure his constitutional right to an accurate plea is protected.
But isn't part of that, though, to make sure that the defendant understands what's being charged mm-hmm. and what facts the state is relying upon in bringing the charge?
Sure, and I think
and to the extent that he says he doesn't remember, doesn't that put some burden on the state then to fill that record, you know, to basically supplement that record?
It
he doesn't remember.
It might. I think it depends. If the state wants to be able to argue that, then I think the record has to reflect that it happened, and the record does reflect it. I'm not aware of any requirement that the record has to be supplemented at the time of the plea. And there certainly was no objection by and the defendant wasn't denying any of this. He just said, you know, I don't deny it. I take responsibility for it.
But isn't the obligation of the court to make sure that he understands what went on, that notwithstanding the fact he doesn't remember, you know, that there's evidence in the record and pointing out that evidence as part of the plea to make sure he may not remember doing it, but now he knows enough about the facts and the record to assume or to admit that he did do it.
Well, and I think that was done, maybe not explicitly, but there was lengthy questioning by his attorney about the amount of time they'd spent together. They'd gone over the case and the relevant law. And the prosecutor asked the questions, and the defendant again said, I take responsibility for this. I just don't actually remember that specific act and a couple of other specific acts. But so I think that he clearly had notice, and it wasn't a situation where he was sort of being browbeaten into admitting to things because he didn't admit to what he wasn't going to admit to. I mean,
but is there anything in that plea transcript that you can point us to that gives that supplemental information?
Other than the reasonable inferences from the record, not from the plea transcript specifically, and I see I'm out of time. If I could just complete my answer to that.
Yes.
But, again, I'm not aware of any requirement that it be contained in that transcript because the cases specifically say the record, and there are numerous other acts, and especially taken together, that constitute a substantial step outside of that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I did want to mention, Your Honors, I think the Hong case, which is cited in our reply brief, it is an unpublished decision of this court, but it's very recent, and I think it's very persuasive. It's directly on point, and it counters a lot of what respondent just said. Hong was pleading guilty to a robbery, an aggravated robbery. He admitted assaulting the victim, but he said he didn't remember taking the victim's property. He said he didn't dispute that he took the victim's property. He said he knew that other witnesses, including the victim, would testify that he took the victim's property, but he didn't remember taking the victim's property. This court reversed that conviction and held that the plea was inadequate and constitutionally inaccurate because, like here, the defendant there said he didn't remember committing an essential element of the crime, the taking of the victim's property. He said he didn't remember that fact. It wasn't a Norgaard plea, just like this wasn't a Norgaard plea. And the court had little trouble sending the case back to St. Louis County and saying, withdraw his plea and we'll have a trial and we'll figure out what happened. And that's what should happen here.
All right. And what about counsel's argument that somehow, even though he can't point to anything in the transcript, we can look at the the file, I guess, and fill in the blanks there.
I would say that that's not true, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, you can look at Hong as a recent example of when this court did not do that. But number two, a couple things. One, the Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 15.01, Subdivision 1, paren R, specifically say that the defendant must state the factual basis for the plea, end quote. That means the factual basis for the plea must come from the defendant personally at the plea hearing. That is, of course, the entire point of asking the defendant what happened, so the court can get from the defendant what happened.
Right,
the cases
but you do
counsel's
have...
Well, ahead. Let me ask, if I don't get to your question, please ask me. The cases counsel's relying on, most of them involve statements of the defendant. Lucier is testimony, they're not statements of the defendant, but they are sworn statements under oath. Lucier involves the defendant at the plea hearing specifically agreeing to allow the grand jury, testimony at the, before the grand jury, to supplement his factual basis. Had that happened here, no problem. Supreme Court says no problem. Because there, everybody's on notice what evidence is going to be supplementing the factual basis. The court, the defendant, and the prosecutor. And if there's a problem with it, the parties then have notice and can address the problem. Some of the older cases involve things like the defendant's testimony at a pretrial hearing, which was looked to supplement the factual basis in what the Supreme Court, it's the Hoagland case, it's from the 70s, and the Supreme Court described that as a very unusual situation. I can't quite remember what the problem was there, but it was not this. It was not a standard plea where then you show up on, you come to the appeal and say the factual basis is inadequate, which the Supreme Court says the defendant can do. And then the reviewing court can somehow look at other evidence that the defendant doesn't agree to correct or contradict things the defendant says at the plea hearing. I suppose if there's one time maybe you can do it, it's if something isn't addressed at all, and it's obvious, and it's obviously undisputed, and it's not addressed at all. Somehow everybody just misses it during the plea hearing, and a defendant shows up on appeal and says, aha! You didn't say that I was ineligible to possess the gun. I didn't say I was ineligible to possess the gun in a felon in possession case. But every fact in the record shows he was ineligible. He's not disputing that he was ineligible. It wasn't discussed at the plea hearing. Maybe, maybe. Here, the defendant specifically said he didn't remember that fact. That puts the fact at issue. That's not just, we never talked about it. When he says he doesn't remember it, that puts some burden, like Your Honor was talking about, puts some burden on the state to shore up that fact. And saying things like, well, you know your mother said you did it, and he says, yeah, I know my mother said I did it, that's not good enough, not in a guilty plea context.
Is there anything in this record about the multiple fractures the mother had and her condition after this incident?
Not at the plea hearing, Your Honor.
Right.
Not that I recall.
All right.
Temper that answer. Not that I recall at the plea hearing, which is the only record that matters.
Okay. You just answered my next question.
To support the validity of a factual basis, under Rule 15.01, the defendant must state it. The defendant must admit it. And so to evaluate the accuracy of the plea, it's not what can the state prove at a trial. That's what counsel said it was. That's an Alford plea. In an Alford plea, it matters what the state could prove at trial, and a defendant must then say, yes, I agree with all that evidence you could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I'm guilty. That's fine. That's not what this was. Not in a regular plea. In a regular plea, it must come from the defendant.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, because let's assume we take out the hammer,
mm-hmm.
because he says he doesn't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we do know. We know he brought a large bag full of weapons. He walks in the house, pulls out the shotgun, loads it right in front of his mother. She says, are you going to kill me? He says, yes. And then she says, why? And then he threatens her that he's going to throw her down the stairs while she's taped to this chair. Aren't those facts sufficient in and of themselves without the hammer to show a substantial step toward commission of the crime? Yes.
Can I just add two facts? Because in the transcript at page 31, counsel was correct. It says that the defendant had a knife and a hatchet in his hand at the time he says, right, he was asked if he had a knife and a hatchet in his hand at the time he threatened to throw his mother down the stairs when she was duct taped to the chair.
True.
Thank you. I appreciate the supplementation of my question.
And thank you for allowing
me. And for the record, I see I'm out of time, but I assume you'd like me to answer the question.
Please.
My answer is no. None of those are substantial steps towards completing a premeditated, intentional murder. Think about every case you've ever seen where a defendant shows up at a scene with a weapon and threatens to kill somebody. That happens a lot. None of those cases are attempted murder cases, not without some other action, like firing the gun at someone and missing, or hitting them but not killing them. Those cases are assaults, or they're terroristic threats, or they're, in this case, kidnapping or false imprisonment for the chair part of this. But until he takes some violent action towards the intended victim, and it has to be towards the intended victim because this is a specific intent crime charged specifically against the mother, until he takes some violent action towards the intended victim, he hasn't taken a substantial step, and it's important to say towards what? Towards first-degree premeditated intentional murder. Everything other than that is some other crime maybe, but it's not that crime.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Very well argued and briefed. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.